Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the post-9/11 torture report due out on Tuesday that already has senior officials in the George W. Bush administration and at the CIA circling the wagons to challenge the report's conclusions. The author of The Interrogator and Education, Glenn Carl, a former member of the CIA's clandestine service who retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats, joins us to discuss the possibility that revelations in the report might inflame anti-American outrage overseas and remarks by the former president on whose watch torture and rendition took place that those operatives and officials involved in torture are patriots. Then we will discuss deteriorating race relations in the country as growing evidence of the disproportionate killing of black men by white police officers and the subsequent sense of their impunity because of the failure of the justice system to even put them on trial appears to be taking its toll on the notion that we are a colorblind society with equal justice for all. Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington, who is the principal investigator of the multi-state survey on race and politics, joins us to assess what can be done to restore justice and the belief that we are a just society. Then finally, we will speak with the senior editor of the New Republic, John Judas, who, along with almost all of his colleagues on the staff of the magazine, just quit in protest at the about-face of the owner, Chris Hughes, the co-founder of Facebook, who pledged to double down on in-depth, rigorous reporting and keep long-form quality journalism strong in our country, quote, but instead decided to turn the New Republic into a vertically integrated digital media company. We'll discuss how much this is about old media versus new, or the actions of a callow dilettante. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He is the author of the recent book, The Interrogator, An Education. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And the American embassies and other U.S. facilities abroad apparently are bracing for possible security threats, anticipating a response to the long-awaited torture and post-9/11 torture and rendition report that is being released on Tuesday. How much do you think, I guess it's impossible to know what the reaction is going to be, given that you know, a Danish cartoonist caused an enormous amount of strife, and so did Salman Rushdie with a book. So do you anticipate that there will be explosions abroad, or is this the way that some of the defenders of the Bush-Cheney program are being crying wolf?
Well, I don't think it is crying wolf in this case. I mean, as you know, the Bush and Cheney defenders of enhanced interrogation and I are on opposite sides of what really shouldn't even be a debate. But in this instance, I think it's simply prudent on the part of American officials to be cautious. You point out the Danish cartoon issue, and we all know from recent painful years the hypersensitivity, I would say the irrational or unfair, dramatically unfair sensitivities of some many Muslims concerning what they consider to be blasphemy. I mean, their norms and Western norms differ on this rather important point frequently. So I think it's wise to be careful. Do I anticipate violence? You know, the Danish cartoon issue, I think it's little known, actually, was not a spontaneous reaction by the Muslim community worldwide. It was actually engineered by some of the hotheads and hothead imams for their own political, theological ends. So populations can be subject to manipulation, as happened with the cartoon issue. It's hard to say. So it's wise to be careful, but that doesn't change for a moment the importance of releasing the report.
So, Glenn Carl, in your book, The Interrogator and Education, you describe how, and the book, of course, is heavily redacted, you recount your intimate involvement in the interrogation of a high-value target, codenamed Captus, in the post-9/11 period, who was rendered from the streets of an unnamed Middle Eastern country and spirited off to one of these so-called black sites where you interrogated this person, and you knew immediately that this high-value target who was supposed to be high up in Al-Qaeda was innocent. And every time you would tell the agency back in Langley that they're wasting their time, they would then tell you to up the ante, that the guy is a cleverly deceptive foreign intelligence asset, and therefore you need to enhance the interrogation.
Right. We mustn't be a dupe. We mustn't be so easily manipulated there.
Right. So the people that were telling you to enhance the interrogation, are they the people who are running now, trying to preemptively circle the wagons and defend themselves against what this report's likely to say?
Well, I don't know that they're the same parties. The ones who were issuing those instructions to me probably were a bit lower down in the hierarchy than the ones who are now the last defenders of the policies and the individuals or institution that did these things. They're of like mind, and they share the there's a combination of honest delusion or misunderstanding, if I want to be more charitable, about the nature of the threat and the nature of the kinds of steps that we should take and what works. And at the same time, rather cynical, if understandable, efforts to avoid being tarred with a failed policy, a failed actions, poor judgment, illegal behavior, and so on. No one wants to be tarred with that sort of thing. So one can understand the defensive reaction. I talk about in my book how even if someone has enough intellectual and moral courage to recognize error, in the CIA, in any institution, frankly, it's unlikely for someone to write a telegram that says, we got everything wrong, we've caused grievous harm to our own interests and to those against whom we were working, and we have to change everything, and I stand up and raise my hand as one of the guys who got it wrong. I mean, I don't know that anyone has ever seen that. Instead, what one writes is says to an oversight committee, for example, is we work very hard to uphold our oath and to accomplish our mission. We constantly check our results and our procedures, and we have made great strides to accomplish our mission to protect national security. Now, both statements can be true, but, of course, the second one might have nothing to do with the fundamental reality either, and I think that's the dynamic, Billy.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He is the author of the recent book, The Interrogator and Education. So when General Hayden, of course, the former Director of Central Intelligence, General Hayden, and George Tenet, along with John McLaughlin, former Deputy Director, and Steve Kappas are the ones that are circling the wagon. The President Bush on the weekend talk shows referred to them as patriots. And General Hayden said that in characterizing the Senate report due out on Tuesday, we're not here to defend torture, we're here to defend history. So what kind of history are they defending? I
know Mike Hayden and think highly of him in general. On this issue, he and the other gentleman you named are getting it wrong, unfortunately. It's sort of a ringing phrase that doesn't mean a whole lot. It's almost like saying, let's march steadfastly towards the future. I'm afraid it really is an empty statement. We're defending history. If that's what he said, I revert to my previous point. People who are the creators and then the executors of a policy are not the ones to whom one should turn for a critique of those policies. This doesn't really happen. It doesn't happen in academia either. If someone has a theory that is then subsequently disproven, you can expect to see 30 years of vitriolic letters exchanged in the New York or London Times over, yes, I was right. I didn't actually mean that black is white or white is black. I meant to say the opposite when, in fact, they said what they said. So I think this is the dynamic, and for I grant the sincerity of the gentleman whom you quoted. We all make errors, and we all are duped, even by the most sincere advisors giving the best advice possible. And I think that's the best interpretation one can give of what happened. You know, I worked with some gentlemen you mentioned, and these are all talented people, and they are patriots. But on this issue, the understanding was wrong, and so was the execution of policy.
So what happened at the CIA in terms of the shift away from specialists from the Middle East who spoke Arabic and understood the histories, cultures, and politics of these countries? Obviously, Bob Baer was sort of run out of the CIA during the Clinton administration, and Graham Fuller, who I speak to fairly regularly, yeah. He speaks Arabic too. He retired some time back. But my understanding is that when the neocons took over with George W. Bush, they purged as many Arab speakers as possible because they thought if you spoke Arabic, you therefore weren't friendly towards Israel. And
well, oh, my God.
But, yeah, but I mean, this happened, this has been fairly heavily documented. But why did they bring in to replace the Arabists in the CIA and, I guess, to some extent, the State Department, or actually to a lesser extent, the State Department, that they replaced, at the CIA, they were replaced by people like Jose Rodriguez and most of the those that had experience in Central America during the El Salvador-Nicaragua wars and
right.
didn't speak
well,
any Arabic.
Jose was, you know, it was a you know, a good yes man to have who would do what the orders were and do it with zeal. And so he fit exactly what was wanted at the time. I don't know about the Arabists, but I think the broader point that I certainly did live and see, which is broadly in line with what you're describing, which is the administration quite powerfully seemed to take the view from the get-go that the State Department and the CIA were a bunch of effete bureaucrats who would be in the way, and that on top of that, nuance, of course, is viewed as a reason to do nothing and as weakness. And policymakers, these were the heroes of the Cold War in their own minds, and they knew how to run the government, and they had in the past, you know, under the first Bush and under Reagan. And they were not going to be second-guessed by time-serving bureaucrats or holdovers from the panty-waisted Democrats and who were who engaged in small bore foreign policy and instead of geostrategy. That was a very clear shift in culture. And it is certainly true that anyone who challenged them at any level of the bureaucracy would was in the way and would be replaced by someone who knew how to say yes.
Well, the amazing thing is that it's still happening. I was looking at a news report the other night where they were talking about how sophisticated the Islamic State's propaganda postings, videos that they post on YouTube are in terms of recruiting recruits to join in the Islamic State's mayhem. And apparently the administration has decided to play catch-up, and they put in charge of the efforts on the part of the U.S. to appeal to disaffected Arab youth and warn them against joining the Islamic State. They put this Latino official in charge. So I'm just wondering whether this strange habit of, or this strange practice of putting non-Arabic-speaking people or Spanish-speaking people in that theater. It just
well, I don't think there's a Latin cabal to replace all experts with Central American experts. Maybe I should be appointed then because I work briefly in Central America too. But it certainly is a classic dynamic in government that you know the executive wants political supporters to be in positions of decision making, and that bureaucracies are even if they attempt to execute their orders faithfully, will act slowly and say, "But sir, the regulation X, Y, and Z, you know, obliges to do the following sorts of things." We see this with the EPA, you know, on. Any number of issues where the law says, you know, we have to work towards saving wetlands, say, and various politicians and then policymakers who, in that on that specific issue, tend to be Republicans, find that it's an inconvenience that preserving a wetland would stop the development of a shopping center, to say. And so you find someone who will say, yes, this is a classic dynamic of politics, which we all have observed. It's not intrinsic, unique to the intelligence process and hostility towards the agency, because it happens to have some people who know that there are something called Sunni Shia and Kurds in Iraq.
Well, most of the criticism, of course, is coming from Fox News and other conservative quarters, and from the Bush administration itself. We haven't heard yet from Dick Cheney, but certainly, as I mentioned, General Hayden and others are circling the wagons. But there's
it's a very orchestrated campaign. There's no question about it.
Well, but apparently there are human rights groups who are criticizing the Senate investigation for completely different reasons, and that is that they don't think it goes far enough, and they have criticized the Senate investigators for not looking into the Bush administration's architects of the programs, and particularly those that gave the legal, you know, justification, like John Yoo. And my understanding is when you asked your superior, who's about to send you off to interrogate a high-value al-Qaeda target has been rendered to a black site, you said, you know, where's the finding? And they pull out John Yoo's peculiar, you know...
Oh, my experience was not unique in the least in that regard. It's absolutely... Yeah, the criticism of the whatever these human rights groups are, that, you know, I'll say something somewhat polemical, and the saying that a fish rots from the head, right? The agency played, I think, a very honorable role. Jim Pavitt was the man who was the DDO, it's the head of the clandestine service at the time, and the instruction came, you guys now have these prisoners, and so interrogate them. And he essentially said, we will do nothing without clear legal guidance as to what we can do. The CIA and the executive agencies are always left holding the bag for policies that come from the executive. And so you will make clear to us, you meaning the legal people, the Department of Justice and the executive branch, what is legal. And we will do the best of our ability to fulfill the mission if we have clear legal authorization to act. And the answer was, well, sure, well, that's a good point, you know, we'll get it for you. And then they, you know, trotted over and had the hack, John Yoo, who, summa graduate from my institution, he may have been, clearly seems to know nothing about the spirit of American or Western law and the, you know, canon, wrote up what was ordered. And that's how it happened. But the agency attempted to get clear legal guidance. Then, you know, the tragedy continued, because in the institution you find people who say, well, once you have an order, then we just follow the order and that's okay. It's a much harder thing to say, wait a minute, you know, even though I'm only the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel and the president has signed this document, maybe I'm not going to follow that anyway. I mean, that sounds treasonous and insubordinate, but at some point, somebody has to say no, and terrible dilemma that we were all presented with, that's what happened.
So needless to say, John Yoo was not interviewed, as far as I know, for the 6,300-page report. Very little of it, I believe, will be made public on Tuesday.
I don't know how much will be. I think the executive summary is tremendous itself, and I've not seen it, but my sense is, from talking with people involved in the process, that the the 6,000 pages, if that's what it is, are exhaustive with dozens of cases, and I think a chronological description of how they played out. The executive summary will still be quite large and will certainly give the main points, which I think if you read my book, you would know, which is that we were ordered to do something that transgressed our own constitution and distorted the oath we were taken, and that was unnecessary, didn't work, and was a policy born in fear and executed by people who were more zealous than exercising good judgment. And it was all unnecessary, and it was a tragedy.
Well, Glenn Carr, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Glenn Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's the author of The Interrogator, an Education. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into whether we can restore justice and the belief that we are a just society. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. He's the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans, and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. And he tweets at Black Bruin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Thank you for permitting me to return, Ian.
Well, Chris, obviously there's been a fairly hideous period of life in America here, in the two Americas, the Black America and the White America, collisions over race and justice in Ferguson and in Staten Island and in Cleveland, and these assaults keep happening. I think at this point, a recent survey said that a black youth has 20 times more chance of being shot by the police than a white youth. What do you think is going to solve this clear and present danger for young black men in America?
Well, I think the first step is to have a more diverse police force. I think that, which is not to say that, you know, they wouldn't have some of these issues with a more diverse police force, but I certainly think that, and the data bear this out, that, you know, with a more diverse police force, you have, you know, fewer and fewer confrontations. And the main reason is because, let's say if you have a black police officer policing a black or even brown neighborhood, that he or she is going to be able to empathize more with the plight of what's going on in these neighborhoods, because they've been there. Some of these cops have even grown up in these environments, so they're a lot more empathetic. And not only are they going to think, I was just interviewed on another program, a right wing program, if you will, and the guy kept saying, "Well, don't you have more black on black crime? Then, you know, isn't that a problem?" You know, he's echoing what Rudy Giuliani said a couple of weeks ago on the Sunday morning talk show. That's not the point. The point is we have to look at the underlying causes, you know, of what's happening in these black and brown neighborhoods, most of which is a concentration of poverty. So this is a structural problem, not just a behavioral problem.
But if we are asking the police to behave better, is there any way to ask young African-American men, particularly those that belong to gangs that are shooting each other on a regular basis and committing crimes, is that too much to ask?
Well, I think so. Let's think about it like this. The police are putatively or supposedly trained, you know, in order to, you know, be able to de-escalate these conflicts. You don't see this happening, you know, with white police and you know, and white suspects. Well, I mean, do we ask them to behave any better? I really think that's a non-starter. I think it's a false dichotomy. So what I do believe, however, is that, you know, we need to, you know, the police need more adequate training. They need more racial sensitivity training. And I'm not excusing the quote unquote behavior of, you know, black youth who may or may not be involved in the underground economy or gang life. The issue is that this is so ingrained, this sort of antipathy, you know, from the police towards black folks and from black folks toward the police, it's going to be really, really hard to root out. But it needs to happen primarily, you know, at the level of the folks who have the authority and who have the guns and who have the weapons, right? And so if there needs to be a lead taken from that perspective, that needs to be the perspective taken that the people who have the guns and the power, you know, should be able to start this dialogue or to be initiate, you know, this revamping of the ways in which these communities, the police community and the black and brown community, interact. As a matter of fact, there was a TV show on the other day and, you know, that focused on Watts. And so we know, you know, what happened in 1965, you know, with the Watts uprisings. And, you know, Watts has never been the same since. Watts used to be a middle-class black enclave until the Watts uprisings, and it hasn't been the same since. So what they've done is they've had these LAPD officers, these community service officers that are in the community all the time. They've even developed a football program where, as a means of developing more cooperation between the police and the residents. So the initiative needs to be taken, you know, by the police force or by law enforcement. And if the initiative is taken by law enforcement and they're offering an olive branch, then the people in the community, you know, will say, well, wait a second, you know, all cops aren't bad. We don't have to be on the defense all the time.
Again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. And he's the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans, and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Post-War South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. He tweets at Black Bruin. But, Chris, you know, my sense is, though, that beyond black and white issues, I think there's a problem with police in as much as, you know, 90, even if 99% of them are good guys, that 1% is worse than the rotten arrow that spoils the barrel because they have a license to kill. Now, and I think this goes on. I think there are some really dangerous people with guns out there in police departments, and I don't know how they can root them out. Even this fellow Pantaleo, and let's face it, the New York NYPD is a fairly good police department by and large. It's headed up by a very enlightened guy. And yet this officer Pantaleo, if you watch the videotape after he's chokeholed the victim to death, Eric Garner, after he's chokeholded Eric Garner to death, you see the EMS people working on him. And then at the last moment, the camera pans around to Officer Pantaleo, and he waves with a big smile at the camera like, hi, Mom, you know, just like he's just totally happy that there's a dead man on the ground next to him that he's killed. I mean, I think that is so deeply troubling. I wish that something could be done to really look into, you know, how people are recruited and what psychological profiling goes in when you recruit police officers, because the actions of a few really undermine the entire public trust in police.
Well, I have an idea. So there's been some research that's been around for quite some time by a colleague of mine at Harvard named James Sedanius, who's come up with this personality profile that's called social dominance orientation. And basically what that is, it's a profile in which people who score high on this social scientific scale tend to see, you know, this, you know, society as, you know, structured in these social hierarchies. And what happens is that they believe, people who score high on this scale, Ian, believe that, okay, you have some people that are born to be in charge or dominance, and you have some people that are born to be subordinates. And folks who are police officers, by and large, tend to score really high on this scale. So if that is part of their psychological makeup, it comes as no surprise that, especially if they're white, that officers like Pantaleo, you know, don't believe that black people or people of color, or perhaps even illegal immigrants, are his social equals. And so, therefore, they don't deserve the same treatment as white folks do. And it's just, it goes back to, I mean, so I was telling this to my class the other day. Okay, so we were discussing Cleveland, we were discussing Staten Island, we were discussing Ferguson, and we go back to what Chief Justice Roger Taney said in his part of his opinion on Dred Scott, that black people have no rights that whites are bound to observe or bound to respect. What has changed since 1857? Apparently nothing. And so there are ways in which these people can be screened out. Like right now, I think most cops take the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personnel Survey, in which they ask about, you know, they ask several questions several different ways to try to root out people, you know, who have, you know, this sort of psychological dispositions that can be pathological, that can lead to, you know, people who are, you know, bipolar, people who are narcissistic, and those kind of things. But the issue is, if they don't try to route out, you know, this bias that a lot of these cops seem to have. Now, I'm not saying all cops are bad, but you have some cops that are obviously biased. They just don't act on these biases. But you have some who apparently act on these biases. And those are the cops that need to be rooted out from the beginning, not after they pass the police academy and get into the field, but prior to their entrance into the academy. As far as I know, they don't have these exams that sort of get at these underlying racial and gender and age and nativist biases. And that needs to happen before they accept it into police academies.
Well, Chris Parker, there's a really interesting interview by Frank Rich of the comedian Chris Rock in the current issue of New York Magazine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know Chris Rock, but he's clearly an extremely intelligent person. And he said some very interesting things where, you know, you hear all this dialogue now about, you know, we've got to heal and get over it and become post-racial and all that stuff. And what Chris Rock is saying is that the black people, by and large, have gotten over it in the sense that they've always been the victims. It's right. The white people in this country who are the victimizers. They're the ones that enslaved black people, that abused them, that lynched them, that raped their women, that did all these atrocities for centuries. And you just mentioned Dred Scott, where the whole, after emancipation, it was reversed for another century or so, and that the onus really is on whites in this country to come to terms with what they've done. You know, they're the ones that need to heal. And that makes perfect sense to me.
Well, so the thing is, so there needs to be some acknowledgement first on white folks' part. So here's another thing. There's this political philosopher who's at Northwestern, I forget his name right off the top of my head. But what he says is that even if you have some enlightened whites, the fact that they are beneficiaries of the system, if not necessarily signatories of the system, that still makes them complicit, you know, in the oppression that continues to take place on a day-to-day basis. So unless they are actively involved in reversing this oppression or doing something to mitigate this oppression, they're complicit in it. It's like, it's like the guy, his name is Charles Mills, his name just comes to me. What he says is especially for white males that are in America, you know, it's like a fish swimming in water. They don't see the water because the system is rigged and tailored to them. So they don't see it. And so there needs to be some way in which they can actively engage in their roles in this oppression, even though they could be enlightened and recognize that there's something wrong, unless they're actively doing something to reverse it or to at the very least mitigate it, they remain complicit. So for people of color, yeah, we have always been the victims. And so there needs to be some healing on our part. Let's get this right. I'm going to have to depart from Chris Rock on this sense, in that we have this latent anger, and sometimes it's very manifest anger in the black community at the ways in which we've been treated in the past and the ways in which we continue to be treated. So, but that's not going to happen unless we see a good faith effort on the part of whites to do something about either, once again, reversing it or mitigating this oppression.
And now is the time, right? I mean, we've reached a point now where a lot of African Americans and also white Americans have come to the conclusion that this has to stop. You cannot have the justice system without justice and with only the appearance of justice. And even conservatives in this country were shocked at the grand jury and not returning an indictment in Staten Island, because we all saw that videotape. I mean, that made every one of us a witness to a murder.
Yeah, but Ian, did we not see the Rodney King videotape too?
Well, but Rodney King did survive, and you know, I mean, this man died before our eyes.
No, I agree with that. I'm saying that is definitely a qualitative departure from what we witnessed with Rodney King. But those cops got off with Rodney King.
And half of Los Angeles burned down as a result.
Exactly. You were probably living in L.A., as was I at the time. Because we were in disbelief that you had tape. This was not some sort of, you know, contested witness statements, you know, that we saw in Ferguson. And Rodney King, we saw a tape. And the guys still got off. So how was that beyond the fact? And I am not minimizing the death of Eric Garner at all, but if you remove that from the equation and we just look at what is similar between these two cases, we have videotapes, you know, we have evidence, videotape, where we can see with our own eyes of what happened. And these guys got off in the Rodney King case, and this cop got off in the Eric Garner case, right? At least at the state level. We have yet to see what's going to happen at the federal level. So, and it just blows me away. So we saw it with Rodney King. We saw no real substantive change. Now we've seen it with Eric Garner. I'm really cynical, and I think most black people remain cynical because we saw what happened with Rodney King. Those guys got off. We saw what happened with Eric Garner, at least at the state level. He's gotten off at the state level. We'll see what's going to happen at the federal level. But I don't think many of us are sanguine about what's going to happen with Pantaleo. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's the same old crap all over again. The only thing that changes is the date and the location, maybe.
Well, Chris Parker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans, and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. His latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America, and he tweets at Black Bruin. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the senior editor of the New Republic, who, along with almost all of his colleagues on the staff of the magazine, just quit in protest. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Judas, who was a senior editor at the New Republic, an active member of SDS and the left in the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. His books include The Paradox of American Democracy, Elites, Special Interest, and the Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives, and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. His latest book is Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Judas.
Hi.
And what's it like, John, being the editor of one of the more influential political magazines in the country and to suddenly find yourself and all of your colleagues out of work? It's an amazing exodus that's just taken place from the New Republic.
Well, it's personally wrenching. A lot of them are people I've worked with for two decades. And the New Republic's a pretty small magazine. There were about maybe 10, 15 editors and then a shifting group of reporter researchers and whatever that come and go. And we know each other pretty well. So, yeah, that is the most disturbing part of it, the feeling that I won't be working with the people, that I might not see them as or talk to them the way I used to. You know, that's the personal side of it.
And in terms of the professional side of it, it's pretty obvious that the institutional talent there, the professionalism that you're talking about with all of these top people who've resigned, it's an extraordinary loss to American journalism. But is it going to be considered a loss to this co-founder of Facebook who bought the magazine and who many think has single-handedly wrecked it?
Well, I think that we'll all continue writing in one venue or another. So I don't think we're going to be missing from the scene. We just won't be doing it as part of one venture. As far as the Chris Hughes and the magazine, he now wants to change it into a kind of profit-making media center. He even has a New Republic investment fund that's going to be attached to it. And that's really completely foreign from what had been the original spirit of the New Republic. It turns it into a business like any other, like some small software startup. So I think if his plan for it prevails, you'll have something named the New Republic, but it won't be anything like what the magazine has been.
But what's extraordinary is that Chris Hughes, who was a Harvard roommate of the founder of Facebook, who bought the New Republic in 2012, he's at the time suggested that he was preserving this treasured journalistic asset and praised the magazine's tradition of tough and investigative reporting, etc. And it's just in July, on the 40th birthday party for the editor, Franklin Foyer, the editor who just quit along with you and everybody else, you know, he talked in terms of the editor being his Chris Hughes' intellectual partner for decades. So what happened from the time that he bought this magazine to both in terms of his stated intentions and particularly his relationship with the editor, who apparently was everybody thought it was a close relationship?
Well, this is a part of the story that I can't help you with that much. I work at home. I made that a condition of my coming full-time to the New Republic in 1994, and I did it because I didn't want to get involved in the intra-office battles. So I see things from afar. I go to I've been to the weekly staff meetings for a long time, and I know the general drift of the magazine. But as far as the relationship between Frank Foer and Chris Hughes, you have to get that probably from Frank or somebody who was very close to them, one of the top working editors, as opposed to me. I'm a writer, not an editor, even though my title was senior editor.
So I take it you weren't invited to the birthday party?
Oh, that birthday party, no.
Right, right.
And I'm not a party animal anyway.
But I just assuming that that this is so public and this is, you don't get this many people resigning en masse unless there's something seriously going on. There were, from what I can tell, virtually nobody stayed on. Isn't that? I mean, and this is not a, this
well,
is
there
not,
were, I think, I think there are three people stayed on in terms of the senior editors, but a lot quit. I mean, and most of the people whose names are familiar quit.
Right, and this is a time in American journalism where jobs aren't easy to come by, right?
Well, it's not as bad as 2009, let's say, but it's not great.
Right.
I'm an old guy, relatively speaking, so it's not a fall off the cliff thing for me, but a lot of people have young kids and mortgages, and so yes, and that was part of it that was so touching for me, was to see them make that decision rather than my making the decision.
Again, I'm speaking with John Judas, who was a senior editor at the New Republic. and he was an active member of SDS and then the left of the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. And his books include The Paradox of American Democracy, Elite, Special Interest, and The Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives, and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. So,
let me say something, though, because you keep plugging my old book, The Paradox of American Democracy, because,
right.
You know, the whole theme of that book was the importance of elites to American democracy and to democratic reform movements like the progressive movement in the early 20th century. A lot of the people there came out of the Industrial Revolution, the financial revolution of the late 19th century, early 20th century, and they realized that in order to keep the country together, they had to do public-minded things. The people who financed the New Republic, Willard Strait and his wife Dorothy, Willard Strait was a J.P. Morgan guy. I think, you know, if you look at the big picture of what's going on here, you're getting people from Silicon Valley who are buying things. And I think there's a story, too, about this Glenn Greenwald operation that the guy from eBay bought. There was a story in Vanity Fair, and it sounded very similar in some ways to what happened to the New Republic, that are not yet, they haven't yet figured it out. And I think what happens with Hughes is he does begin as a public service, then he decides that, well, I'm going to make this a profit-making enterprise, and I'm going to have an investment fund attached to it and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, it just merges into the great American market, and you really lose that any sense of noblesse oblige and public service and public trust that was... There's always been an essential part and an element of making American democracy work. So, you know, that in that sense, it's a larger historical development that's taking place.
Well, there's American democracy and there's American capitalism. If a guy buys something, he owns it, right? I mean, we've had a history of press barons, and you have a very powerful...
Yes, of course we have, but they have usually had their views tempered by some kind of public commitment, some kind of commitment to the public service, the national interest. That was true of the Grahams and the Washington Post, Sulzberger's and the New York Times. It was true of the people who founded think tanks like Robert Brookings. And that was, and in that sense, those publications, those think tanks, made an important contribution to American democracy. But when they just become instruments of the market, when you could say, well, they're, you know, everything's capitalism and everything's making a profit, and if it's not making a profit, we'll just shut it down, then you really close off an avenue of by which American democracy has worked. And that's what I think that's happening here.
Well, there have, of course, as you mentioned, John Judas, been other internet billionaires. Jeff Bezos of Amazon bought the Washington Post and the Intercept.
And we'll see what happens there. I mean, actually, the Washington Post, which is my hometown newspaper, has improved in the last year or two. But I think that's more because they've got a new editor that predates Bezos, who's excellent. So... but that's, again, yes, that's very important. Let's see what happens, because the generation that came of age in the early 20th century were very important to the progressive movement. They were important to the New Deal. The Roosevelts were part of that. I mean, they were upper class people. They weren't, they were products of inherited wealth. They weren't products of the American working class. They weren't Eugene Debs. So we'll have to see what happens with Bezos and Chris Hughes and this guy Omidar and Peter Thiel, who financed Ted Cruz. Are they going to be public-minded, or are they going to be people of the market who want to subordinate all values to other to profit. So that's what concerned me again about what happened at the New Republic. I've had other editors I've admired there who've gotten bounced for various reasons. They didn't get along with the owner. They weren't that good at administration and so on and so forth. But what distinguished this episode was that it was part of a transformation of the product itself, of the magazine and of the web page. And that's what really, I think, precipitated this, this flight out of it.
Well, there's an assumption out there that, you know, newspapers and journalists and magazines are in what is often derisively referred to as the dead tree business, that somehow print journalism and magazines are relics of the past. And my understanding is that during this transitional period, since this new owner, Chris Hughes, took over the magazine in 2012, that the people that worked there were absolutely on board with the idea of getting a stronger digital presence.
So that's absolutely true, and I can count myself as one of them. I had a discussion with Chris Hughes at the beginning in which I said that I didn't think the magazine itself, print magazines, would last longer than 4 or 5 years, and he said no, say, you know, 7, 8. You know. So it was. We were always. I think maybe you could say Leon Wieseltier, the literary editor, was. His section really thrived in print. As far as the rest of the people, everybody was anticipated that we would eventually shift all our operations to the web.
So the idea that that somehow this was, you know, sort of the new millennial wire generation moving in and then basically coming up against a bunch of sort of stuffy old print journalists wedded to the past is absolute nonsense, right?
Yes, I think that's wrong. I don't think that's a correct view of what occurred. And when Chris Hughes took over the magazine, he was, I thought he was overly enamored, if anything, with the print magazine. And it worried me that he would be so committed to that when he saw that it couldn't increase the circulation that much, because that, again, I think that they're dinosaurs, he would become disillusioned with the whole operation. Well, I don't think he became disillusioned with the whole operation, but then he wanted to plunge us into web journalism in a way that really undermined the purpose of the magazine and of the whole product, which is to create journalism, not just simply off the top of your head opinion, but writing based upon expertise, research, whatever, considerable thought, there's a lot of web operations where people write things in 5 minutes off the top of their head, and if it's provocative enough, they get a lot of hits. That's not what the New Republic's about. And the question is whether you can have a political publication like that on the web. I don't think it's easy to have a publication like that and for it to make a profit. The New Republic made a profit, I think, 1 year in 100. And The Nation has rarely made a profit. National Review, Buckley always had to subsidize it. So these kind of ventures are ventures, but they are part of things that are done for the public interest by high-minded people who are willing to support them. And if they aren't willing to support them, they won't exist.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, when you to think about what goes on in cyberspace. You know, never before in history has so much been said by so many about so little. And the idea that you'd want to have more blogging, more, tweeting type of culture as opposed to in-depth news analysis and political and investigative reporting. Just, it's mind-boggling. I mean, did something happen to the Chris Hughes, the fact that his partner lost his bid for Congress? Did that change him in any way? What happened? It seems like they're two different people. The guy that started out with this buying and pledging what he wanted to do with the New Republic, and the guy that just a few days ago wrecked it. Or, you know.
I really don't know. I don't know. I mean, I had lunch with Chris Hughes, and I had a few discussions with him when he right after he bought it, and I talked to him a few times. But I don't know what his mind was. I mean, there are a lot of people who buy things and say they're going to do X, but end up doing not X or Y. And this is another instance of it, and I think something must have happened. I mean, there must have been a moment at which he did change, because what he said he was going to do at the beginning and where he is now are very different.
Well, is it possible that all of the alumni that have just quit, which is the almost the entire core of the magazine, could they start again? He obviously owns the New Republic logo and label.
I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I'm just saying that, but I mean, I'd be happy if it did, but I don't think, you know, it's very hard to do these kind of things. Somebody, you'd have to have an angel or two that was willing to fund the whole operation. And it would involve people taking chances, taking risks with their lives. It might be easier for a lot of the people just to, you know, join other publications. I suspect that's what's going to happen. But if somebody proposed that, I would certainly welcome the idea. I think it would be very nice.
Well, John Judas, I thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with John Judas, who up until a few days ago was a senior editor at the New Republic, an active member of SDS and the left in the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute, and his books include The Paradox of American Democracy, Elites, Special Interests, and the Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives, and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. His latest book is Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.